From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Santa Clara.
Santa Cruz.
Union City.
Hayward.
San Francisco.
I'm from Fremont.
Yo, I'm San Jose, just downtown.
Coming up, we'll hear why activists say now is the perfect moment for more environmentally friendly jobs.
Not only are the polar bears in trouble, our cousin Pookie's also in trouble, right? With sea level rise.
Then from jobs for the environment to an environment at risk, a story about eating in Japan after the nuclear disaster at Fukushima.
So basically, if you see grown in Fukushima, to you that means safe.
Yes, yes.
Environmental stories from the Bay and beyond today on Cross Currents. Remember back in 2008 when the terms green economy and green collar jobs were buzzwords and a big part of Barack Obama's presidential campaign? The basic idea was this. If we're going to curb the climate crisis, we need to replace energy sources with green ones. The transition will be a lot of work, but the upside is we have many people looking for work, especially in poor communities of color. Then we stopped hearing about green jobs as much, but it turns out the green jobs movement is alive and well and ready to resurface. With new construction projects booming, growing environmental activism in the African American community, and a new influx of money, it looks like it's time for Green Jobs 2.0. KALW's Liza Veal has the story.
We're in the industrial part of West Oakland. There aren't any sidewalks because 18-wheelers trump humans in the pecking order here. The pollution from the nearby port and freeway make the place tough on life. But people still live nearby and work right here. Like at the Cypress Mandela Training Center, a tuition-free boot camp that teaches green trades like solar panel installation and eco-friendly construction. It's just before lunch, and students are finishing up a project. Eric Jones is standing with a group of classmates. He says the program changed his life.
Reporting from Cypress Mandela, the number one pre-apprenticeship in the world.
You guys have so much team spirit.
Got the same goal and the same mission. Any problems or anything like that, they kick you right out of here. They don't tolerate anything like that.
You guys aren't going to drop out?
Definitely
no,
not.
No.
Green job training programs are obviously a pillar of the green economy. Cypress Mandela has been around since 1994, and they've become more purposefully green as technologies like solar panels and gray water systems have become popular. But instructor Eric Shanks says being resourceful comes naturally to poor communities.
For example, my father always believed in removing the existing siding and reusing whatever was good, and you discard what wasn't good. And if you didn't have the money, that's what you were forced to do anyway.
Shanks says that all the big construction projects in the Bay Area right now, like the BART extension, the Brooklyn Basin, and the port, are utilizing the same kind of ingenuity. Instead of demolishing everything with machines, the city is requiring that existing structures are dismantled piece by piece, each bit salvaged for reuse. That requires a lot more manpower than demolition does. And that's where Cypress Mandela comes in.
This state in Alameda County, there's a lot of work. There may not be enough workers, and we may not be able to train enough for the demand once all of it lands. I mean, you'll feel that crunch very shortly.
So the local construction boom, combined with eco-friendly requirements, local hire agreements, and solid workforce training, means those mythic, too-good-to-be-true green-collar jobs are happening. The green economy is also moving forward because people who haven't been environmental activists in the Sierra Club way are joining in. It's Sunday worship service at the church by the side of the road in Berkeley, and Reverend Carol Ambrose is preaching.
Hallelujah!
Ambrose says he's bringing environmentalism to the pulpit.
Not only are the polar bears in trouble, our cousin Pookie's also in trouble, right? With sea level rise. We need to hear about it in our houses of worship. And so we are bringing one another together to that end.
This month, Reverend Ambrose launched the Green the Church campaign. He's enlisting 1,000 churches nationwide over the next year to join the cause. That means retrofitting their church buildings to be efficient and mobilizing their congregations.
In Berkeley, we won some legislation to get a soft drink tax. The congregants were able to hit the streets, and so we're proud of that. But there are a lot of things statewide. We're fighting to get a ban on fracking in the state of California. They just won in New York, and we're trying to articulate that to the African-American community.
So there's new employment opportunities, a growing activist base, and the final piece, legislative success, like California's cap and trade bill, which means we cap the amount that corporations can pollute. Any more than that, and they have to pay. And a quarter of that money must go directly to disadvantaged neighborhoods. And the cash is rolling out now.
This year, actually, the monies are rolling out for the first time right now, which is why it's so exciting.
That's Vian Trung with the Greenlining Institute. She and other activists fought for the piece of the bill that earmarks money for low-income neighborhoods. In the Bay Area, that means funding public transit, electrifying AC transit buses and port vehicles, affordable housing by transit hubs, car-sharing programs, low-cost solar panels, and urban forestry.
This is the biggest pot in history ever to communities that have been disproportionately impacted by climate change.
And it's paid for by polluters. Now, maybe you're thinking, wait, so we only get these things in exchange for more pollution? Doesn't that cancel out the improvements? But Trung is optimistic. She says we've gone from subsidizing polluters to taxing them. And now they're paying for the infrastructure that will allow us to wean off of them.
I'm seeing the real kind of collaboration and new stakeholders coming to the table as never before. I am so excited about this new shift.
So it wasn't like this before? This is really like a new focus?
Yes.
This issue.
It's never had the constellation of stars aligned in this way before.
The cap and trade money isn't a one-time thing. It's new tax law. So areas like West Oakland, where we started this story, they can begin to make up for decades of disinvestment. Back at the Cypress Mandela Training Center, teacher Eric Shanks leads me through the heavy machinery shop warehouse, electrical and plumbing workshops and computer labs. I ask him about a poster of graduates from a year or two ago. He starts at the top left and points to every single person in the picture.
She's a carpenter. He's a carpenter. She's an electrician, operating engineer, plumber. He's a laborer.
How do you remember all this?
Because I trained him.
And with renewed interest in green-collar jobs, he hopes to train a lot more. In Oakland, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now let's cross the ocean over to Japan and back in time to the year 2011 when a 9.0 earthquake shook the island and set off a deadly tsunami so powerful that it shifted the Earth's axis by several inches. And then came the terrifying news of a nuclear explosion at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant. Reactors melted down, releasing giant plumes of radiation into the atmosphere. And the question on many people's minds here in the Bay Area, would it reach us? Over the years, this concern has not gone away.
Moving on to the continuing nuclear crisis in Japan, a radioactive wave is headed toward the United States.
There continues to be serious concerns about whether the radiation from the Fukushima nuclear plant disaster has reached our shores.
Last summer, KALW's Ali Budner traveled to Japan with a group of Bay Area journalists and students to report on the long-term effects of the disaster. She brought back this story about fear and eating in Fukushima.
Okay.
I head towards the sliding doors of the supermarket. With the bright fluorescent lights and cheerful music, this could almost be a grocery store in my neighborhood. But I'm in Fukushima, Japan.
My name is Michio Kainuma. I was born in Fukushima Prefecture.
Fukushima, a name that evokes fear for some. But to Michio Kainuma, a spry 61-year-old English teacher and my guide at the supermarket, Fukushima is so much more than its radioactive reputation. It's home.
And the green pepper, this is really cheap and fresh. And
I've met up with Kainuma to do perhaps one of the most basic and yet most controversial things you can do in a place after nuclear disaster. Prepare a meal.
I'm going to make tempura tonight and with using all of the fresh vegetables here.
Oh, beautiful. That sounds delicious.
Okay,
yeah.
Despite the supermarket's promotion of local food and Kainuma's positive attitude, I'm wondering, what's really okay to eat here? Right after the nuclear plant exploded in Japan, I remember walking into a grocery store in San Francisco and noticing the big bulk bins of seaweed were all wiped clean. People thought it would protect them from the radiation that might be drifting towards them from across the Pacific. But ironically, as people scurried to protect themselves here, some people much closer to the contamination didn't even know a nuclear meltdown had occurred.
Even the hydrogen explosion occurred, I didn't know that. Because we couldn't see TV.
Because you didn't have power.
Yeah.
And no one came to tell her.
No.
So when did you find out that there was radiation coming this direction and landing?
Maybe
on
10 days or 15 days.
Just after the earthquake, the Kainumas were focused on meeting their basic needs.
Food. I think the first thing I think about is food.
She and her family stood in a long line at this very grocery store, waiting to get what limited food was available. Radioactivity was far from their minds. They just didn't want to be hungry.
Of course, I knew about the explosion of the radioactive substances, I really worried about that invisible fear.
Invisible. As Kainuma said, they had no way of knowing how much danger they were in or where it was. One of the scariest things about radiation is we can't perceive it with any of our senses. Now Kainuma knows full well that her city was caught in the shadow of nuclear fallout. But here, buying food more than 3 years later, she shows little concern about it. As she shops, I wonder how she went from fearing irradiated food to enthusiastically buying local. Maybe patriotism plays a role too. Kainuma's husband worked for the local government, and Kainuma herself has volunteered with them, distributing leaflets about efforts to monitor food.
So basically, if you see grown in Fukushima, to you that means safe.
Yes.
She points out what she tells me is a unique inspection code on every bag of rice. There's even a phone number.
And it says it's a toll-free dial, 012, la-la-la-la-la. You can see the information from here about this bag.
Have you ever called?
No.
You just trust?
Yeah, trust. Yeah, because I have been to the inspection center, and I can clearly see that it's latest technology shows it is safe. So I perfectly trust all of them.
Trust. That might be what this all boils down to. As we check out and leave the store, I can't help thinking that shopping for food is a form of trust. After all, I often look for and trust labels that tell me whether the food I'm buying is organic or local. Of course, I might be more skeptical if I were watching out for nuclear radiation. And naturally, some people in Fukushima are.
My name is Chiaki Oku.
Oku is 56, and like Kainuma, she's an English teacher who lives in Fukushima Prefecture. Unlike Kainuma, she has completely changed her food habits.
I was worried about the food and water right after the accident.
Even though food from Fukushima is cheaper, she still buys milk and vegetables from other areas. I'm talking to her on Skype, and she brings her computer over to the kitchen. Going through the produce in her refrigerator is like a tour of all the other parts of Japan.
I have radish from Ibaraki Prefecture. And potatoes are made in Hokkaido.
After the disaster, Oku's children and grandchildren moved to a different part of Japan because of the radiation threat.
I was very sad and lonely and confused.
She decided to stay because, well, it was her home. I tell her about Michio Kainuma's trust in the government and the food system.
It's her choice. So I don't want to say it's dangerous. Don't eat this one or something. Depend on the people, the personal thinking.
She has a bad feeling about the vegetables.
Just only me, but I don't want to eat. I feel it.
So Oku's decisions about food, just like Michio Kainuma's, are based on trust, or lack thereof, a feeling in the gut. Understandably, she's overwhelmed when she imagines intensely restricting her shopping like this for the rest of her life.
Maybe I will eat that food in the future, near future. But from now, I have to take care of my body.
And she's not about to put her health in the hands of the government.
Japanese government say, don't worry, it's safe. But this is not true, I think.
Now, there are clear reasons why some people like Shiaki Oku don't trust the authorities. For one, the Japanese government, along with TEPCO, the company who owns and runs the nuclear plant, notoriously mishandled the meltdown disaster. And there's a revolving door between government and the nuclear industry in Japan. One group, the Union of Concerned Scientists, called it a perfect example of regulators being too close to the industry they oversee. And it's regulators from that same government overseeing the food supply. But there are ways people can test their food directly. There are 26 food monitoring centers in Fukushima, just for homegrown produce, like this one.
Taking our shoes off and putting on plastic slippers to go inside the food monitoring center.
At this center, you walk across squeaky blue sticky mats that keep you from tracking in extra dirt, dust, or anything from the outside world that might be contaminated with radiation.
People were extremely concerned about food safety and their products. So we built centers like the one you're standing in with devices you see here.
Kenichi Hanzawa is the technical official at this monitoring center. Stout cylindrical machines stand at attention on short tripod legs. They look like cousins of R2-D2, and they're designed to measure becquerels, units of radioactivity. Hanzawa demonstrates the nearly silent machine with a sample of rice. The whole thing is faster than an ATM transaction. This rice checks out. It's under the new local standard, 100 becquerels of radioactive cesium per kilogram. To put that in context, that's 12 times more strict than the U.S. radiation standard. But Fukushima is also a big commercial farming region. These farmers have had their own set of problems. This orchard is in a valley green with peach trees, alive with crickets and cicadas.
My name is Shinichi Katahira.
Katahira is a fourth-generation peach farmer and owner of Michinoku Orchard, in the part of Fukushima known as the Fruit Line. This used to be the second largest peach-growing region in the country. It's far enough inland that they didn't really suffer from the earthquake or tsunami. But the next day, when the power plant exploded,
we were advised to evacuate, and we thought, it's all over.
Katahira's orchard is about 40 miles away from the power plant, not close enough to be officially evacuated, though many people did leave.
But for people like us, farmers who own this land and work on this land, we couldn't just pick up and leave. So we waited for more information.
Eventually, he decided to stay and continue farming. But there were some obvious obstacles. How would he guarantee his crops were safe? Katahira and other farmers consulted with experts at the local university.
The first thing we decided to do was to use high-pressure washers to wash the bark of these trees. Since it's all fallen on the ground, our next step was removing the upper 5 centimeters of the soil. That's a lot of soil that has to be moved.
And there was no official place for it to go. With limited resources, they trusted what becomes conventional wisdom after a nuclear disaster. Radioactive cesium, once bound to clay, doesn't travel much.
We buried the contaminated soil in about a half acre of our land, just a little ways from here.
Not all farmers in Fukushima have pressed on. Some people were forced to leave their contaminated land. Fukushima Prefecture used to be the fourth largest rice producer in Japan, but has dropped to seventh.
Life has changed a lot. It'll never be the same as before the accident.
As we leave, he gestures to his trees.
Please, try my peaches.
I indulge.
Oh, this one looks good.
Katahira says he's constantly testing his fruit to make sure it's safe. And standing here under his trees, I believe him. But will people buy it if they have the choice? Should they? That begs the question, how dangerous is radiation in our food? What do we know about how it affects our health? We know that one very large dose from a bomb or a meltdown can cause death or severe sickness. But there's also naturally occurring radiation all around us in the air, soil, even in food. Bananas, for example, contain 130 becquerels per kilogram of radioactive potassium. That's higher than the level of radioactive cesium Fukushima allows in its food. Doctors and researchers, including from the National Academy of Sciences, are concerned about the increased risks for cancer and genetic mutations. But they still haven't determined the exact impacts of low doses of radiation over time. So that's more uncertainty, which itself can harm people's health. The World Health Organization concluded that in Fukushima, like in Chernobyl, the chronic stress of the nuclear accident could outweigh other health problems. What if you thought about radiation every time you went shopping, or ate, or cooked?
We are going to make sushi and tempura and noodles. Okay. Could you help me?
I would love to help you.
I'm at Michio Kainuma's home now, watching her prepare dinner. Rice and vegetables for tempura.
2 cups of rice.
Kainuma cooks traditionally, carefully considering every detail of the meal. She listens to the changing pitch of the tempura oil as it bubbles. She watches the color of the boiling meat.
So now you see on the surface of the oil bubbling.
But what's the protocol for an ingredient that can't be sensed? We all have our own way of dealing with the unknown. The Kainumas choose to eat locally.
Itadakimasu! Cheers!
At the end of the meal, Kainuma's husband turns on his favorite classical music while she slices up fruit for dessert. She asks me if I want a peach.
How about a bite of peaches? Fukushima peaches?
Peaches, the symbol of Fukushima City. Fukushima has a long way to go before it solves its problems with radiation, the future of food production, and the dislocation of residents. But larger questions loom too. Japan is crisscrossed by fault lines. All 48 of the country's nuclear power reactors remain shut down in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. But industry and government leaders are pushing to reopen one in the coming year. And here in California, the active Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant sits just miles from fault lines. So while we don't understand the full impact of nuclear fallout on our food and our health, maybe we should try a little harder to grasp it, because it could just be a matter of time before something like Fukushima happens again, in Japan or here. Until the long-term studies are done, though, people have to feel their way through this disorienting and invisible threat. As I savor this slice of Fukushima peach, I feel connected in some small way to the land where it grew, and to the people I've met who still have to navigate between trust and fear. For KALW Radio and the San Francisco State Fukushima Reporting Project, I'm Ali Budner.
KLW's Ali Budner reported that story last summer when she traveled with a group of journalists and students to Fukushima. Now all the stories made on that trip are being presented together this coming Saturday at the Japanese Community and Cultural Center. For more information, go to klw.org and click on Cross Currents. And we'd love to hear from you. Email us your events, comments, and suggestions at news@klw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW or call us. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Angela Johnston, Chris Hambrick, Marlo McKenzie, Ted Muldoon, Colin Peden, Seth Samuel, Judy Silber, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Sandhya Dirks. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And this music is by Bay Area percussionist Mo Staiano. He's the headliner at Berkeley Arts on Saturday night. Event starts at 7:45. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.